nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
We're pleased to welcome Dr. David Resnick from USC Chapel Hill and NIH. Dr. Resnick has his MA and PhD in philosophy from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and his JD from Concord University School of Law. It's exciting to note he also has his BA in philosophy from Davidson College, the underdog heroes of the creative community. Dr. Resnick was assistant and associate professor of philosophy at University of Wyoming from 90 to 98 and the director for the Center for the Advancement of Ethics at UW from 95 to 98. He was an associate and full professor of medical humanities at the Brody School of Medicine at East Carolina University from 98 to 2004, and associate director of the Bioethics Center at ECU and University Health Systems from 98 to 2004. He's published over 100 articles on various topics in philosophy and bioethics, and is the author of 6 books. He serves on several editorial boards and is an associate editor for the journal Accountability and Research. And currently, he's also the vice chair of the NIEHS Institutional Review Board. Dr. Resnick's impressive career as a philosopher has reached not only into bioethics, but widely into philosophy and science. Just for my own interest, I put together a brief and incomplete list of research interests and topics, which I'll present alphabetically.
Oh, no.
The demarcation problem, DNA patenting, environmental justice, ethics of climate change, ethics in nanomedicine, ethics of science, the Gaia hypothesis, genetic diversity, neuroethics, the precautionary principle, research bias, responsible conduct of research, social epistemology, scientific realism, and you could go on. On top of his impressive academic career, Dr. Resnick also plays piano, keyboard, and harmonica, and has a 2007 CD release entitled Rock Garden 2, available for purchase in the lobby, just kidding. Tonight, Dr. Resnick will be speaking on conflicts of interest in biomedicine, so please help us welcome Dr. David Resnick.
Thank you for having me out here. Can everybody, I'm not mic'd up. Can people hear me okay? Good. All right. So thank you again for inviting me here to Purdue University to give this talk on conflicts of interest in biomedical research. One of the best things about this talk as far as your university is concerned is that I'm doing this entirely for free, because I work for the federal government now and I cannot receive any money for doing this kind of thing. We've had changes in our rules that don't allow me to do that. So it's out of the goodness of my heart that you have me here today. So anyway, but I really have enjoyed my stay so far. It's been worth it to have the just to talk to people, learn about what you're doing here. I also want to let you know that this research does not represent the views of the NIEHS or the NIH or George Bush, for that matter. These are my own opinions on things, and that's the way it'll be. So I'm going to just give you some background information about conflicts of interest, and I'll do some definitional stuff, explain sort of why conflicts of interest are an ethical problem in biomedical research, look at how they can affect research, and then talk briefly at the end about what can be done about them. I guess there are some philosophers in the audience today, and we're not going to do any real serious philosophy in this talk, so you can leave the room now if you want. But we may do some serious philosophy in the discussion section that you stick around. I have thought about these things at a deeper level, even though you won't see that right now. Okay. So let's just talk about some background. The background to this kind of thing is that, and actually I was out here today, I took on a tour of your campus and this very lovely campus you have. But the background really is that university industry collaborations have been increasing since the 1980s. A large percentage of research now, about 30%, probably even more by now, this is old data, 1996 data, is on campuses, is funded by industry. And if you look at all R&D in the United States, including all the federal government research and even accounting for the giant Department of Defense budget research item, still private industry funds about 60% of all research and development done in the United States. So they're a major player in research. There are also financial interests that researchers have today. Again, this is some old data from a 1996 study by Krimsky and colleagues, but they found that 34% of lead authors in biomedical research articles had financial interests, such as stock, equity, or intellectual property. They've also had various positions on companies and had patents and things like that. Universities also have financial interests, such as ownership of stock or equity and patents. And universities are involved in startup companies, and I've talked to some people today finding about Purdue's efforts in this direction. Along those same lines, universities now have pretty active technology transfer offices that encourage people to commercialize their works, and that the university gets a piece of that money when things get commercialized. Somebody violated one of our rules, I think, the cell phone rule. Okay, so if we go back a little bit, some of the things that really sort of helped to increase this, the Bayh-Dole Act was, and the Technology Transfer Act are two important pieces of legislation that were passed in the 1980s. Briefly, what these do is they allow researchers to patent discoveries that are made in government-funded research. Previous to this, if there were discoveries that were made in government-funded research, you would have to develop that. You would have to have what's called a non-exclusive license. You couldn't; it would be licensed by the government in a non-exclusive way. And a non-exclusive license means that basically lots of people can license the thing. So you wouldn't be able to have one person having monopoly control over it. Which, as far as business is concerned, you really want exclusive licenses so you could have monopoly control over a product. The result of this is that a lot of research that was done and funded by the government basically sat on the shelf because the research was out there and academics were interested in it, but there wasn't enough incentive for industry to bring this research to the market and invest in it. So Bayh-Dole Act did this, and it had that effect, the effect that they thought it would have, and it encouraged a lot more transfer of technology from the public to the private sector. It probably was very much important for some economic growth we had in this country, development that took off from this starting really into the 90s. Really, you could look at a lot of the R&D investments and everything in the 90s coming out of especially biotech and things like that coming directly out of the Bayh-Dole Act. It made technology transfer a key part of university operations. And there's Robert Dole right there for the Bayh-Dole Act. Another thing that happened during this time, and it sort of goes along with the Bayh-Dole Act, is that pharmaceutical and biotechnology companies began to greatly increase their investments in research and development from, say, around, $10 billion a year or maybe even less during around 1980 to currently about $50 billion a year they invest in research and development. So this has led to situations, problematic things that have been labeled conflicts of interest in research, and I want to just give you a few cases before we actually analyze what these cases are about, just to give you some ideas of the facts. So really probably the most famous of the conflict of interest cases, the one that's had the greatest impact on policy and everything, has to do with the death of Jesse Gelsinger in a gene therapy clinical trial conducted at the University of Pennsylvania. He had a disease that's called ornithine transcarbamylase deficiency. It's a genetic condition which he's unable to, he doesn't produce a protein in his body that he needs to break down ammonia, which is a product of protein metabolism. His condition was well managed with medications and special diet, so he was not someone that was desperately ill and dying. He sort of wanted to be in an experiment, really, to help other people. And that's kind of the thing that he was, his main interest in being in this experiment. They had considered actually doing this experiment on very young children or babies with this disease who are likely to die and are desperately ill, but they thought that that might be problematic. In hindsight, that might have been a better path to choose. But what happened was, this was what's called a phase one trial. So it was the first time that this experiment had been done in a human subject, and there was no expectation of benefit. So he was not going to benefit. They were really just looking at the safety of doing this procedure. So what they were doing was they were using an adenovirus to transfer a gene into his liver that would allow him to make his liver cells, if the gene functioned in his liver cells, to make ornithine transcarbamylase so that he could process ammonia with his liver. Well, he developed a massive immune reaction to the when the adenovirus was infused into his liver, and he went into respiratory arrest and died, unfortunately. Lawsuit, of course, followed, was settled out of this court for an undisclosed amount of money. And one of the things that the lawsuit alleged was that Gelsinger was not adequately informed of the risk of the study or the researchers' financial interests. Just in terms of the financial interests, the informed consent form did say something very vague, like the investigators or the university may profit from the results of this study, or they have some financial interest, or something vague like that. They didn't actually spell out what these financial interests were. Well, what came out is that the investigator, lead investigator, James Wilson, had 20 patents on gene therapy methods, and 30% of stock in a company, Genovo, that had sponsored the study, and it's a company that he had founded. In fact, he was lured away from another university so they could bring him and this company and his research with him to the University of Pennsylvania. The amount of stock ownership also he had violated Penn's policy they had at the time, limiting your stock ownership to no more than a 5% interest in the company. So his was 30%. The University of Pennsylvania also held stock in the company. And the company was giving $4 million a year for this gene therapy institute that had been started up to sponsor things like this clinical trial. Sort of feds came down and looked at this. The Office of Human Research Protections, which is in charge of overseeing research funded through public health service programs, they found out that Gelsinger had not been informed about problems with animal studies with adenoviruses, and that financial interests were not properly disclosed, and that adverse events for this study had not been reported properly. Investigators are, when something bad happens in clinical research, an adverse event or also an unanticipated problem in research, you're supposed to report that to the sponsors and the IRB, but they weren't reporting this properly. So what happened really, there was a lot of examination of the safety issues and everything around gene therapy after this, but there were also organizations pushing for development of more conflict of interest rules and guidelines that came out of this, some of them like the NIH and the American Association for Medical Colleges, American Association of University Professors, developed some additional guidelines for conflicts of interest in research. And this got a lot of more people interested in the topic. Just some other cases to run through. There's a lot of cases. I just want to give you a sample of some of them. One case involved Retin A, which is, I guess, a treatment for wrinkles. It was the article was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And it alleged really that you could reverse the effect, it claimed the article, that you could reverse the effect of aging using Retin A. When this happened, the company's Sales of Retin-A, as you could imagine, went up tremendously from 0.25 million to 1.2 million tubes in 1 month. But it had not been disclosed that one of the authors in the study had received compensation from Johnson & Johnson, the maker of Retin-A. This had not been disclosed. And also there was someone that wrote an editorial that it was receiving money from Johnson & Johnson. There was also published the same issue. And when they looked at the research more carefully, they found out that the results had been exaggerated and that there had not been it was not a well-designed study because there was not control put in place for bias and there was no double-blind design. Some other examples of conflicts of interest have occurred on FDA advisory committees. The FDA uses committees of scientific and medical experts to give it advice on when it's considering approving new drugs or taking actions on drugs, like taking them off the market or changing warning labels and things like that on drugs. So they convene these committees of experts. And what has come out, and this is just one example here, where these experts had interest that were giving some advice on vaccine developed by Wyeth, had interest, financial interest related to vaccines on this committee. There have been some other incidences like this where people on these FDA committees have had financial interests related to the very products that they were asked to evaluate for their participation on the FDA. I might add that the FDA has what is called an institutional conflict of interest as well, in that a large percentage of the salaries of people that work at the FDA are paid from industry fees. Okay, so that's part of the budget of the FDA is those salaries. And as you can see, if the drug company is paying your salary, a large percentage of your salary, it might make you want to treat the drug companies with kid gloves, not be so hard on them. Another sort of case that's interesting to think about is that clinical researchers today receive financial incentives for recruiting subjects into clinical trials. Clinical research actually has become very profitable for medical schools and even private practices. So you have actually a lot of private practices, a lot of doctors that are just working in out of their office that really don't know a lot about doing biomedical research are nonetheless participating in clinical research studies of, say, new heart medications and things like that. And why are they doing this? Well, one reason is the financial payoffs. It's not just out of their love of science or whatever that they're doing this. So one of the ways that people get financial payoffs is they actually, in some cases, will get a finder's fee for enrolling research subjects in clinical trial. And if they don't get that, they also get what are called patient care costs. And patient care costs, suppose you get paid for a research subject $3,000 in patient care costs. And all you do for that subject is they have, let's say, 6 clinic visits, which are half-hour clinic visits. And during the clinic visit, you're taking blood pressure and you're taking some, maybe a blood sample and some other work. Well, you can see how you could get paid a lot more in patient care costs than really you were expending in terms of your own costs. And you could therefore use that to help cover your overhead and things like that. And that's a way it's an incentive. Another development has happened that a great deal of research these days in medicine is actually conducted through organizations called contract research organizations. I think it's actually approaching 50% of all clinical trials are done this way. They're not done through medical schools anymore, but they're done through contract research organizations, which link pharmaceutical companies to physicians in their practices and help recruit patients and help to monitor and audit the trial and things like that. Okay, so let's go to this sort of more general problem about defining conflicts of interests. I think we can say generally conflicts of interest involve interests. We can talk more about what those are. They also involve problems with your judgment or your decision making or your behavior that you may have as a result of those interests. And they're situations where, as a result of these problems, you may violate your ethical or legal duties. So if, say, one of your ethical duties as a researcher is to be objective as you can in evaluating the data and designing the experiment and things like that. Maybe it's an epistemological duty, too, or whatever we'll call it. But let's just say researchers have this obligation to be objective. Then a conflict of interest could skew your objectivity, could make it so that you would be less than objective. Go back to the Retin-A case where, you know, you've got money on the line here. You could make a lot of money, maybe you have stock in the company and so forth. If you can get some good results out of this research, you could get money, so it may affect your objectivity. Another duty in human research is to inform subjects about the risks of research. But if we go back to the Gelsinger case, that the investigator, James Wilson, you can say, well, if he told Gelsinger about all the risks, maybe Gelsinger wouldn't enroll in the study. So he has an incentive, really, in some cases, to try to downplay the risks so that you can encourage enrollment in your study, and you want people to enroll in the study so that you can get the research done and to make money. Okay, so it's kind of like the proverbial case, shall we say, of the fox guarding the hen house is what you have in a conflict of interest. So just to get a little bit more precise, I would define a conflict of interest as this way. Conflict of interest is a situation in which someone has an interest, which can be financial, and we often think of the financial interests, we think of them that way, but they can be personal or professional interests that can come into play as well, that has a significant chance of causing that person to fail to perform their ethical or legal duties. So I really think the bottom line here, some people don't even add this latter part. They just say you have a conflict of interest when your judgment is compromised. But I don't think that's enough. I think really we have to think about, you know, why do we care whether your judgment is compromised? And we care that your judgment is compromised because you're going to fail to do something that we're expecting you to do. Give me an objective opinion, give me a good legal opinion, a good scientific opinion, perform the way you're expected to perform. So a conflict of interest then can affect your judgment, your decision making, or your behavior. These different aspects of your conduct. I think one way of thinking about this is, the reason conflicts of interest are really such a problem in ethics is because we're not angels. If we were angels and we always made the correct judgment under the circumstances, we always did perform the ethical duty we were supposed to perform and legal duty and so forth, we wouldn't have conflicts of interest. The problem is that we're not angels, we're imperfect, we're human beings. And so our judgment, our decision-making behavior is sometimes compromised by the interests that we have. Okay, another thing concerned about a conflict of interest is that you don't actually have to have violated a ethical or legal duty for you to have a conflict of interest. So we don't have to show, for instance, that you actually skewed the data or fabricated data or something like that. The question is, well, was there a significant chance that you would have done this under the circumstances, or that something could have been amiss? Okay, if you think about it, we almost all of us have all kinds of conflicts of interest all the time. It's not just scientific research; it's not just in medicine. There's lots of cases from as mundane as where you have, say, a parent that is asked to referee a soccer game of one of their child's soccer game, where you can see they would have a personal interest related to their child, but they have some kind of ethical duty to be fair in terms of refereeing. My favorite one, no one's really thought enough about this, but when you go to a dentist and they recommend that you get a crown or whatever, they do make money when they make this recommendation to you. And there's a question as to whether, you know, I guess you could get a second opinion or whatever, but, you know, how many people are likely to always get a second opinion from the dentist when they get recommended for dental work? Actually, medicine has made a separation between pharmacy and medicine. That they made that years ago. Before there was a separation, you go to a doctor and they would sell you the very medicine that they were recommending that you take. But you could see how that would be a conflict of interest. But that hasn't actually happened with dentistry yet. Okay. And actually, dealings with stockbrokers, I don't know if you've ever bought mutual funds, but you know, people that sell you mutual funds are going to make money off of selling you that fund. They have a duty, however, to give you good advice, and there's a conflict there. Okay, organizations can also have conflicts of interest because they have interests and they have duties to comply with ethical or legal requirements. These can affect the decisions or actions made by an organization. Organizations are not conscious, rational agents. They don't actually consciously decide to do things the way individuals do. But we could still speak of organizations having responsibilities, organizations taking actions and whatnot. Someone was asking me earlier, what do you think is the most serious problem with conflict of interest? And I said, well, it's really this problem of organizational, institutional conflicts of interest, because I think this is one area where we have the least ability, we've done the least thinking about how to deal with this situation, we have the least ability to manage it in any reasonable way. I'll just give you a sort of a typical problem is, you know, suppose a university decides to accept a gift with strings attached, okay? And maybe the strings attached to the gift are, well, we want to change the university curriculum in a certain direction. We want to have you include this major in one of your majors. We want to have you do this X, Y, and Z. And with these attached strings to the gift are things that would change the values of the university, could compromise the university in certain ways, change what it's all about. So, and, you know, who's going to make that decision? The board of trustees, the president, whoever, in terms of accepting that gift or whatever relationship it would be with private industry. Okay, so some other things just sort of to get out of the way that is often mentioned with conflicts of interest. A conflict of commitment is not the same thing as a conflict of interest. Really, a conflict of commitment involves how you're going to make best use of your time. So, say a typical example, if you're consulting, say you have a consulting business you do outside of your university position, you could have problems if the time you spend on this business interferes with your other duties, such as advising students or teaching classes or whatever. But we wouldn't really call this a conflict of interest unless it actually started to threaten your judgment, make you so you're not fulfilling your legal or ethical duties. And there's also, of course, conflicts of duty where you have really different duties that are conflicting. Suppose, typical situation in medicine where you have a patient with HIV or some other condition and they are a threat to other people with this condition. So you have, but you also have a duty of confidentiality not to disclose their medical problem. But, you know, how do you balance that against protecting other people from harm? And again, we wouldn't call this a conflict of interest unless you start to have an interest that could actually affect how you weigh those different duties. Okay. Basically, I've said earlier that conflicts of interest can distort your judgment or decision-making and behavior. This can lead to bias, error, misconduct, and other problems. I think, for the most part, conflict of interest operate at a subconscious level. Okay? So a lot of times you'll hear people say things like, well, I don't see how this money could be a problem. Okay? I don't see how, so suppose you're talking to a doctor and you see that the doctor has got all this stationery from a drug company, and you know they've got a stethoscope with the drug company's name on it, and all sorts of gifts they've given, gotten, received from a drug company. And the physician says to you, well, you know, I would never allow this a pen to affect how I prescribe medicine. I would never allow this to affect my judgment. Well, the problem is that you may not intentionally, deliberately prescribe a drug or something because of your this gift you got from the company, but it might affect you at a subconscious level. So it changes your behavior in ways that you don't even know it's affecting you. I think there is actually evidence now. There's been some social science research done on how these conflicts of interest affect you at a subconscious level. But even more obviously than that, think about it. Businesses have known for years, when it comes to advertising, that so much of advertising affects us at a subliminal or sort of a subconscious level. We get things, you know, soft drinks associated with sex and cars associated with sex and so forth. And so, you know, it triggers certain parts of our brain. And the pharmaceutical industry has known this for years, that gifts do influence people. Whether they want to believe it or not, they do. Okay. Another sort of reason to worry about conflicts of interest, I think maybe the most important reason, is it's not just that they're going to affect your behavior or your judgment, but they may undermine trust in the trust the public has in you as a researcher, the trust that other researchers have in you. Because I guess they think that, you know, even if they don't know that you're going to mess up, that you're going to violate your duties in some way, that you're going to act improperly, they may start to doubt whether you will be acting properly, that they think you might be not trustworthy. And there's really, in research, there's so many, we could go on and on, but trust is really central to research in terms of collaborating with other researchers, the whole peer review process, the public support for science. Science, the public won't give money to science, won't participate in clinical trials, and so forth if they don't have some trust in science. I'd like to just briefly mention, I don't think I'll go through all this. You can read the studies up there, and I have the citations at the end of this handout. If you're interested, I think this will be posted on a website or something like that. But there's a growing body of evidence that for what we shall call a funding effect in scientific research, that there is a link between the source of funding and the outcome of research. In some cases, it's very strong, much more so than you would expect by chance. So you get the outcome favors the company's products much more so than you would expect just if this were just research that were done by chance. Here's a study by Ridker and Torres. Here's an interesting one. Friedberg and found that 95% of industry-sponsored articles and drugs used in cancer treatment reported positive results, as opposed to 62% for non-industry-sponsored research. So that's quite dramatic difference there. Here's one. 98% of drug studies published in symposium proceedings favored the sponsoring company. And here's sort of a more systematic analysis done by Beckman et al. I think a plausible explanation for this funding effect is that researchers' financial interests of the sponsors have affected the judgments and decisions made by investigators, that they have biased what's happened in some possible way, that this is not just sort of chance. There's this kind of explanation for it. And how might this work? Well, at just a level of funding, just a level of money, how can you affect the outcome? Well, you can fund what you want to prove, okay? So, you know, you want to prove that this drug is, you know, going to be effective. So you fund as many studies as you can. And if studies are working, you continue the money, you continue the funding. But if things are not going well, you just withdraw the money. Just say, oh, well, we can't fund that anymore. We're going to stop. And this has happened several times in biomedical research where companies have pulled out of studies in the middle of things because things weren't going well. And people said, well, you know, you really, you know, what's going on here? Is it just not thinking to make money, or you don't want to see the clinical trial through the end? Is this a patient safety issue, or is this just an economics issue in terms of your funding? Some other areas. In the terms of research design, there's sort of a truism that in science that if you don't measure something, you won't detect it. Okay, so you have to. There are variables that you would measure clinically. That, for instance, maybe there's some liver enzyme value you didn't measure in a study that just won't turn up. Or maybe it's some electrolyte value in the blood, you know, a calcium level or a sodium level or something that was not well measured in your study, okay? Maybe you had reasons to think this might be a problem if you did measure it, that it would lead, you know, you'd have to say, oh, well, there's this risk of this liver damage. So you just don't measure it. You design the study so that certain things aren't measured that really should be. Or another way of not measuring something, or at least not measuring it properly, is underpowering your study so that you don't have enough statistical power in your study to prove the effect you're looking to prove that could be proven. A good example of this is some pesticide studies that have been sponsored by industry in very small numbers, like 50. Or something, 25 to 50 numbers of subjects where they gave people pesticides and found no adverse effect. Okay? Well, maybe the problem was, you know, you just didn't have enough people in your study to really be finding that adverse effect. If you had a larger study, if you had designed it a little better, you would have been finding that adverse effect. But they weren't interested in finding the adverse effect. They were actually interested in finding no adverse effect in humans because that was, you know, would be more profitable for them. As we saw earlier, I think bias can affect informed consent. Even if you don't deliberately skew your consent, I think if you have a financial interest in research, it just seems more likely that you're going to talk up the benefits of the study and downplay the risks. Data collection. The cases we've looked at haven't involved fabrication or falsification of data, but there have been a lot of cases of research misconduct, and money has been a factor in many of those cases. So you wonder, you know, does a conflict of interest sometimes actually lead people to fabricate or falsify data? And then probably most commonly, even if you've done everything else right, a conflict of interest is going to show up in how you analyze and interpret the data. And that's always an area of science where there's a lot of free play, okay? There are many different ways often to analyze the data. You look at the data in different ways. You get different sort of results by looking at it in different ways. And interpretation is even more ambiguous than data analysis. So you're going to tend to sort of spin the data in a way that favors your hypothesis or favors your product or whatnot. And also publication. And I'll look at a couple of cases where there has been companies have selectively published favorable results. So private companies are not required to publish their research. They have to, when they submit, say, research to the FDA, the FDA will know about the research, but the FDA does not make that known to investigators without the company's permission. The FDA treats that research basically as confidential business information. So there could be some adverse event reactions that are not published by the company, at least for some time. The FDA is keeping it secret as well. So this will take us really to one case where this happened, the Vioxx case, where Vioxx is a COX-2 inhibitor manufactured by Merck. It was in a whole class of other COX-2 inhibitors. There was a study. Merck reported the results of the Vigor study to the FDA, which showed that Vioxx users had 5 times more heart attacks than users of another study, Aleve, that's not a COX-2 inhibitor. So the FDA had this knowledge as early as 2000, and investigators knew about some of the problems with Vioxx even before that. In another study, they did not mention also 11 of the 12 investigators in the Vigor study had financial relationships with Merck, which sponsored the study. So move ahead a little forward. In 2001, the FDA warned Merck that it had misrepresented the safety profile of Vioxx in its promotional campaigns. Then it changed the warning label. Eventually, it had put a black box warning label on Vioxx. And in 2004, Merck withdrew the drug from the market after another study came out, the approved study, that showed that Vioxx could more than double the risk of stroke or heart attack when taken for more than 18 months. And this was published in 2005. So Merck then had to defend itself from thousands of lawsuits from Vioxx users who had heart attack or strokes while on the drug. Here's the first trial concluded, awarded $253 million to a widow of Robert Ernst. That will probably get reduced, but there are more going forward. To date, there are 88,000 people that have developed cardiovascular problems while taking Vioxx. Now, not all these may be due to the drug. I mean, they may have had cardiovascular problems anyway, and that has to get sorted out in trials and whatnot, but that's a large number, and there have been 13,000 lawsuits. So, you know, the moral of this story really is that the FDA knew about problems with Vioxx. Merck certainly knew about problems with Vioxx. Investigators knew about problems with Vioxx, but the results really didn't come out for several years. We're talking about several years where people were taking the drug where it could have been withdrawn from the market or had some additional warning labels placed on it before then. Just another interesting case. 1995, a company, Boots Company, tried to force Betty Dong to withdraw a paper on medications she used to treat hypothyroidism. Basically, they had funded her research to compare their drug, Synthroid, to other hypothyroid medications. And what she found was that Synthroid, the generics, were just as safe and effective as Synthroid, the company's drug. And in fact, she said, we could save, the government could save hundreds of millions of dollars a year if people were switched from Synthroid to generics. Okay? Well, this is not good news for the company. This is not what the company wanted to have Dr. Dong prove. Her paper had been accepted by the Journal of the American Medical Association. She had signed a contract giving the company permission to review results prior to publication. The contract also required her not to publish her work without the company's permission. And so they threatened to sue her on this contract, and they spent 2 years trying to discredit her research basically by reanalyzing her data and showing that you must not have done this study properly and things like that. Well, she did withdraw the paper to avoid this lawsuit, but fortunately, eventually the company gave up in pursuing her and allowed the results to be published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Now, one lesson to learn from this is for universities to be very careful about the contracts they sign with companies in terms of giving companies the right to hold up publication. I think most universities today are going to where they will not allow these kinds of contracts where they say the company can delay publication for a reasonable period of time, but they cannot completely stop publication like they tried to do in this situation. Okay, so what should we do about conflicts of interest? Well, I think one of the things that most people say you should do is to disclose conflicts of interest. Many journals now, if you've been submitting work to journals, they'll have you declare any financial interest you have relevant to the research. Universities have policies requiring researchers to disclose financial interests, and these policies are actually driven largely by the NIH and the NSF in terms of their policies on conflicts of interest. There's a question about disclosing conflicts of interest to research subjects. I happen to favor such disclosure. There are some medical researchers that think that this might not be a good idea, that it might confuse subjects. It might be too much legalistic language. They might not understand what all the financial relationships are about. I'm not sure I buy that, but there is that argument. And, you know, generally, some of the good things about disclosure is that it promotes honesty. I think it allows people, if you're going to evaluate an article, to see what the source of funding is, so that if you have maybe any questions about that there were some problems with the study design or the analysis, at least you might give the article a second look or whatever if you're evaluating it, so you can see the source of funding. You know, if you find an article, for instance, that proves that cigarette smoking is not as dangerous as other studies say, and this is an article published sponsored by a tobacco company, then you might, you know, have some second thoughts about that article. Also, one of the worst things that can happen in research is when you have a conflict of interest that you did not disclose, and then it later comes to light. This can just make everybody think that you're totally not trustworthy, that you're just the research is poor quality, you're totally unethical, the research is tainted. I think this would happen clearly in the Gelsinger case, where there were conflicts of interest that were found out later and really led to distrust. Just give you a recent example of another kind of interesting study. Here we have, this actually came out last week, that a researcher, Claudia Henschke, she was a corresponding author for a large study published in New England Journal of Medicine showing that 80% of lung cancer deaths could be prevented by early detection through CT scans. This is an extremely important result if this holds up, because lung cancer is one of the kinds of cancer that we don't really have an early detection method for. We do have it for breast cancer, prostate cancer, other kinds of cancer, bowel cancer, but not lung cancer. Well, the article disclosed it was funded in part by the Foundation for Lung Cancer Early Detection, Prevention, and Treatment. And there were some other sponsors, the National Cancer Institute and others helped to sponsor it. There was no conflict of interest disclosed in the article, although it turned out that Henke does have patents related to CT scanning that probably should have been disclosed. This came out in a New York Times investigation. And also, what was not disclosed was that the foundation that gave this money was almost completely underwritten by Liggett Group, a cigarette manufacturer. So this, you know, immediately led people to view this as tainted by tobacco money. Here's a quote: "I would never publish a paper dealing with lung cancer from a person who had taken money from a tobacco company," the editor of the journal, the American Medical Association. You know, she can say that in her position because she's not the editor of the journal, she's not the editor of the New England Journal, so maybe this is a little bit of I told you so or something like that. So all along, Henschke's research has been controversial because critics have argued it's really not as clear-cut that this large number of deaths could be prevented as she has claimed, or this research group she's been working with. So the National Cancer Institute is sponsoring a $200 million clinical trial to determine whether CT scans are more effective than X-rays. Now, more generally, you might think about this. Is there anything inherently biasing about the fact that the money came from the tobacco company? Would that mean that the research results had to automatically be invalid? That somehow there's some magical thing that as soon as the money comes from a tobacco company, it means that the results must be invalid? I'm not sure. I think people are hypocritical about this, that really what worries people about the tobacco money is the potential for bias or the potential for a bad image or mistrust or whatever. But if the results stand up to further scrutiny, then the data and the data is good. It really shouldn't matter where the money has come from. Same thing with a pharmaceutical sponsored study. You know, you can't just say, well, because the study is sponsored by a pharmaceutical company, then the results must be invalid. No, the results are invalid if they don't stand up to further scrutiny, replication, and things like that. Okay, well, sometimes disclosure is not enough. What people do sometimes in conflicts of interest is to come up with conflict management plans. So you might develop some mechanism of having independent review of a situation that involves a conflict of interest. Maybe you could have a committee that reviews the research design, the data that comes in, publications, and other aspects of research, just to make sure that there aren't ethical or scientific problems with the research, or to try to deal with these as they come up. And then sometimes there are some conflicts that are so problematic that disclosure is not enough, conflict management is not enough, and that they really actually should be prohibited or altogether avoided. Just an example of one is the NIH and the NSF have some rules for grant reviewing that basically prohibit you from reviewing grants of people, certain people that you have close personal professional relationships with, like colleagues at the same institute, supervisors, students, things like that. The idea is if you look at, say, something like grant review at the NIH, it's really a situation that could not be managed if you had these kinds of conflicts. It could become extremely biased, and there might be very little to do about it because really there is no sort of second level of appeal. The reviewers have so much power on NIH study sections and NSF review panels that if they have a conflict, they could dramatically influence the outcomes of those deliberations. There's probably no way to really control that with some management or something like that. Universities have also adopted some rules limiting ownership of stock by companies. The NIH has adopted some rules recently, and I think this is probably more of a public relations move more than anything else. But they limit consulting for industry with pay. They prohibit researchers from doing that. They prohibit, these are researchers that work at the NIH, intramural researchers, prevent researchers from owning stock in pharmaceutical or biotech companies, or actually receiving money from universities to give guest lectures like I'm doing right here, except in certain cases where you can do that. So how should you decide whether you need to prohibit a conflict of interest? Well, here's some things I would throw out there. How strong is this conflict of interest? How likely is it to influence judgment, decision-making, or behavior? This is a really difficult sort of empirical question. It boils down to looking at things like, well, how much money is involved, right? Would you be influenced by $1, by $10, by $100? What does it take to really significantly influence your judgment or behavior? That's the kinds of questions you have to get down to when you're thinking about things like this. The ability to manage the conflict of interest. Is there some kind of mechanism, peer review, independent review, or some kind of way that we could allow the conflict of interest to happen and have some kind of safeguard to prevent bad things from coming of it? The consequences of prohibiting the conflict of interest, or allowing it really, will the prohibiting the conflict of interest have an adverse impact on research? Many times there's just no way of getting around some kinds of conflicts of interest. For instance, everybody has some kind of financial interest related to their research. Everybody, okay? In the basic sense that your salary, even if you don't have any patents or stock or anything in a company, your salary as a researcher, your professional livelihood, depends on your success in research. So in an indirect way, almost everybody in academia stands to make some money from the research they do. Well, should we ban research where any money that could possibly influence you? That would seem to be too radical. We would have to ban all academic research or say you can only do research when you're funded by your own, you know, your own private foundation you've set up. You're just a completely amateur researcher with no professional interest at stake in it. That doesn't seem right. So there's a lot of other situations where if you tried to ban the conflict of interest, you would have such an adverse impact on research that you couldn't go forward, so you shouldn't ban it then. Another thing to look at is just the trust issue. How does this conflict of interest affect the public's trust in research? There may be some conflicts which are just such a major problem from public relations or whatever that even if they're not likely to have such a major effect on research that you might consider banning them because it looks bad. And maybe the tobacco money is a case in point. You know, maybe tobacco money is not that corrupting in and of itself, but maybe it just looks so bad from a public relations point of view to be funded by a tobacco company if you're doing health research that you really shouldn't have that kind of a relationship. Some other policies that have come up in terms of conflicts of interest that I think are worth discussing in this context are registration of clinical trials in a publicly accessible database. So what this is and that what is many most biomedical journals require now is that if you're going to have results of a clinical trial published in a journal, the clinical trial has to be registered. And what that means is that so far all it means really is that you have to tell what the clinical trial is about, give a basic overview of the research design, how many subjects are involved, where it's being done, the sponsors, things like that. And if you have any publications that come from the clinical trial, those have to be listed or linked to the registration. The idea is to sort of get openness here, right? That we don't have the problem with FIOCs where we have these clinical trials that have been done that only the FDA knows about, FDA and the company knows about. And so what we want is we want to have researchers and patients have access to these clinical trial outcomes. A problem I see with this registration as it's been implemented so far is that these registration databases are not open enough. So what you don't see are data. You don't see the raw data will not be there. You also will not see research design described in enough detail that a researcher could actually figure out what's going on. They're mostly research schematics. So we'll say, this is a double-blind crossover study of this, we're doing this, and we're doing this and that. But they don't really tell you, say, the details of the statistical design and analysis and the endpoints and things like that. As I mentioned earlier, contracts with companies, those should have close scrutiny to make sure that you don't give companies the ability to actually block publication so that research can get out there. Something I've suggested and others have suggested, and actually we're seeing a lot more being done now, is to try to have government funding to counterbalance industry funding. So if you look at say the results that are presented when a company wants to have its drug approved by the FDA, the company sponsors research. When the FDA is looking at the research to decide whether to approve the drug or not, the FDA sees mostly research sponsored by the company, not independent research by the NIH or whatever. So there's just a potential for skewing just in terms of where the money is coming from. So I think it makes sense to try to counterbalance this so we have, say, in a good way, is comparative trials, comparative clinical trials, where you say, compare Vioxx to other drugs. That's what the Vigor study was about in these other studies, so you can see whether a drug is really better than its competitors. Some more radical policies, which I don't really favor, is some people would say that we should ban or severely limit industry-funded academic research. We should just kick the private companies off the campus. Campuses, research conducted on public universities or whatever should be at public universities should be sponsored by government grants or maybe private foundations, but not by private industry. I don't see this as a very realistic option, but some have suggested this. Some have suggested banning some types of funding, such as tobacco funding, but I wonder where that would lead. I think that raises significant issues in terms of academic freedom and could lead to banning of pharmaceutical funding, biotech funding, other sources of funding where you have some questions about the source. So just to sort of wrap things up, when you think about the relationship between science and money, I think there's sort of three approaches people take. You're either a capitalist and you think money is good, more the better, let markets rule, let's be laissez-faire, about hands off. Maybe you're a socialist, an idealist. You long for the days of, say, pure research, untainted by money, untainted by politics, as if these days ever existed. Where the only thing that mattered was a search for knowledge for its own sake and the truth and things like that. And so you want to basically kick all the greedy, money-grubbing corporate people off campus. Or you take the approach that I take, is I tend to be more a realist and pragmatist about these things, recognizing that there's really no way to do science without money, that really what you have to do is, I would say, the best approach is to try to regulate these relationships, try to deal with the relationship so that you sort of maximize the benefits of collaborations with industry and minimize the sort of risks that you get out of collaborations with industry. And again, it would be developing regulations and guidelines and things like that. So I've used up enough time. I think we have to finish up. Thank you.